Welcome everyone to the Damage Report, and boy do we have some damage for you today. Things have been rough, although you probably don't need me to tell you that. Look, of course, we're gonna be updating you throughout the video on the situation with coronavirus, both what some states and cities around the country have been doing to try to limit people's exposure to it, but also some of the continuing misinformation that has been flowing over TV and radio waves that is endangering people's lives. Let's just keep it real. So we're gonna be going over some of that. Later on, we will be talking a little bit about the Democratic debate. We did do several hours of commentary immediately following it on the Young Turks last night. That is now available on the Young Turks YouTube channel. If you'd like to see our thoughts on in-depth response to videos, things like that. But I'll be giving you a few of my thoughts to one of the ways a Biden surrogate attacked Bernie Sanders immediately following that debate. But we've also got a candidate who's gonna be joining us. We're gonna be talking about DC statehood. We've got a ton to get to, so why don't we jump right into it. We've known for some time now that in terms of using the power of government to try to protect people who've been affected by the coronavirus, for Donald Trump, the people he's most concerned about are those who are on Wall Street. And so we know he's been pushing for efforts that would potentially help the stock market, which has been doing horrendously over the past few weeks. And this weekend, he got one of his biggest wish list items. And that was that on Sunday evening, the Fed took the extraordinary move of cutting rates by 1 percentage point to near zero. The last time it moved them that low was in 2008 during the financial crisis. Trump has been asking for this for some time because he believed that it will be what is necessary to stabilize things and restore, you know, some sense of lacking panic in Wall Street. Did it work? Well, as of this morning, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down more than 2,700 points, or nearly 12%, as coronavirus measures rapidly expanded. The drops on Wall Street followed steep falls in Europe, where stock indices were down as much as 11% Monday. And that plunge just this morning wiped out all of Friday's 2,000-point gain in the Dow. So remember, he like had that press conference and he timed it so that it would sound good. And then the market would close, and then the answers portion would come where he would make clear that he doesn't really have much, like we don't have a timeline for any of this. And what do you know, Wall Street was still paying attention after the market closed. And so the lack of real reforms, the lack of real support for people who are gonna be struggling more and more as the situation progresses, that is having an effect. And to give you an idea of how significant this is, multiple times the trading was halted. That thing where, you know, where like if a certain amount is wiped out almost instantaneously, then they halt things for a bit. That thing was that was super rare in the past that now just happens like every day a couple of times. Well, let's put it in perspective. The biggest Dow losses of all time in one day, let's bring up this chart. You're gonna see that next to each other, right in the middle, those are only 4 days apart. You notice years all over the place. Like 1987, 1929 is a big one there, 1932 obviously. We've got two entries now on the top 10 list just from the past week or so. And we know that Trump is gonna be talking later today. Maybe he'll do something to make sure that we don't have a third entry to that list. But so far he appears to be learning slowly, if at all, in terms of what people expect from the government response here. That's Trump. Now, thankfully, Trump is not in charge of everything. And so mayors and governors have been making major changes to try to limit people's exposure to coronavirus. Starting at 8 p.m. Monday night, restaurants and bars across New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut need to close to anything but takeout and delivery business. Movie theaters, gyms, and casinos must also close, but grocery stores can stay open. So this is not a full curfew or quarantine or anything like that. But they're going to be sort of forcibly enforcing the prohibition against crowds of certain sizes getting together because they had been giving recommendations, the CDC has, for some time. But many of these places were staying open, and so restaurants would have hundreds of people in them at any given time. And that is the sort of environment where you can expect the possibility of coronavirus being transmitted. Now, they were sort of loath to take this move because many of these businesses had already, of course, been hurt. There's the belief that there will be layoffs and possibly business closures if this goes forward. To potentially limit some of the damage, bars and restaurants will be allowed to sell alcohol for consumption off premises, according to the governor. I don't know exactly how that's gonna work for bars. maybe you can bag it up and take it home, but they're not in the business of selling bottles of liquor or anything like that. So we will have to see. So look, that's the East Coast. Big changes there, lots of stuff being closed down. Not everything though. And while Cuomo seems to be taking it seriously, Mayor de Blasio was seen at the Park Slope YMCA this morning. That's this morning, by the way. He went and worked out this morning at a YMCA as all of the power of government is saying, please don't congregate in these big areas. And tonight, of course, presumably that YMCA will be closed down. I guess he wanted to fit in one last workout. And look, I get it. When you find a good gym, you want to use it, but people are also watching you. And apparently, according to reporters outside of that YMCA, passersby like saw his car and stuff and were talking about how much they hated him as a result of it. Look, maybe that's going a little bit too far. But we do have to worry about what messages we're sending. I've been very critical of Donald Trump for continuing to shake people's hands and not self-quarantine after being exposed to the virus. As far as I know, de Blasio has not been. But if we're saying people should avoid these sorts of venues, maybe lead by example, okay? Now, it's not just the East Coast though. Chicago is closing down a number of different sorts of venues. And here in California, Gavin Newsom on Sunday urged people 65 and older and those with chronic health conditions to isolate themselves from others as just a general rule. Hours later, Eric Garcetti, mayor of LA, said that LA bars and nightclubs will close and restaurants must halt dine-in service and limit their business to takeout orders until March 31st. The order became effective midnight Sunday. Movie theaters, gyms, and fitness centers also will be closed. Grocery stores, pharmacies, and food banks will remain open. And look, I would expect that at this point, this sort of policy is probably going to spread to large cities, especially around the country. And we've never really seen anything like this, not during our lives. And for a lot of people, this will seem very scary. It appears to be what's necessary, though. Again, even these measures are not designed to make sure that no one becomes infected with coronavirus. And if the government takes this seriously, and if they start to make testing kits available, the biggest gap that we've had so far is in the ability to actually test people. If that gap is filled, then you could expect that over the next few weeks, over the next month, if this gets continued, then you will see numbers continue to rise. And I know that some people will be scared by that. Some people will think, well, clearly all of this was a waste of time if the numbers continue to go up. But that will almost certainly not be true. Understand that we have something like 4,000 cases in the United States right now as of us going live. That is going to rise. And the reason for that is that we do not have 4,000 people who are infected with the coronavirus. We have 4,000 people that have tested positive for it. And if we start testing people, those numbers will go up. But that will not be a defeat. That will be a victory because we cannot start to contain this thing until we know who has it. And so in the short term, even these measures, which someday perhaps will be pitched as, wow, we really overreacted, they are necessary to give us the time to just get an idea of what's actually going on. Get the numbers sorted out, get the testing kits universal across the country, and then we can start to reassess this sort of thing. It's going to be difficult, I understand. And I would only say that for those of you who are worried about this, you do need to self-isolate, you don't need to hoard. I would say that to the extent that this sort of quarantine, limited though it might be, will have a negative impact on people, that negative impact is exacerbated when people in a panic buy up far more than they need or could possibly hope to consume. And I will reassure you that while some things are shut down, you can still go to grocery stores and pharmacies, and there is virtually no reason to believe that the supply of things that will be sold in those stores is going anywhere. You do not need to worry about having access to these things. The only fear in the short term is that people will buy up far more than they need. But those companies are not shutting down. The factories are not shutting down. The food and all of that will continue to be available. You just need to stay calm and protect yourself and those around you. And by the way, it's not just in the United States. Italy has finished its first full week of a near total shutdown. Spain followed suit this weekend, barring people from leaving their homes except to go to the grocery store or pharmacy. That is beyond what I've seen in any areas here in the United States so far, although France has had a blanket shutting down of bars and restaurants as well. So just bear that in mind. They're grappling with the same thing as us. These measures might seem extreme, but experts seem to believe that they are necessary. So let's just do what's necessary to support each other in what might be a difficult time to come. Okay, with that, we are going to take a short break. When we come back, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
There has been an effort underway for some time to make DC into a full state and give it the representation that many activists there say it deserves. Are we getting close to that actually happening? We're joined now by Tyrone Sims II to discuss. Tyrone, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, thanks for having me, John.
Glad to have you on. And so, look, as I pointed out, this is something that people have been working on for some time. Why now does it seem like we might be getting closer to that? Can you tell us a little bit about the recent developments?
I think now, obviously, we're getting closer because Congress finally has passed some legislation, H.R. 51 to be exact, which would give D.C. its statehood. Years prior, the past couple decades, actually past three decades, I'd say, a small handful of Democratic progressives partnered with D.C. residents have attempted over those years to go forward D.C. statehood. But even during the Obama administration, there was never any traction amongst the majority of Democrats, at least Democratic representatives of the House. But now that majority exists, and it's definitely a big step forward in D.C. getting into statehood and its constitutional rights.
So do we know how many people have gone on the record that would potentially be voting on this to say that they're supportive of the effort?
That's a good question. I couldn't give you a definitive answer. I do know that I couldn't think of a single D.C. resident that would be against this. The problem that exists now, as you're probably aware, John, is there are thousands of bills that are sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk that the Congress has passed. And right now, that's the biggest roadblock.
Yeah. So tell me, we'll talk about what could happen in the future. But for right now, if you live in D.C., what sort of representation do you actually have?
So in D.C., you have a shadow member of Congress, in this case, Eleanor Holmes Norton, who's an incredible woman and leader. But she can only vote in subcommittees and committees, so she can't vote on the floor. At the same time, they have shadow senators, but their power is so limited that you never really hear from them. So, you know, the only representation in Congress that D.C. residents have is those shadow members being able to influence those with whom they caucus, in this case, the Democrats, to vote in D.C.'s favor.
Yeah, and I will say, look, at least for me as a member of the media, I almost never hear about any of those conversations, any of that influence. I'm sure some of that exists behind the scenes, but as to an outsider, it seems pretty much invisible. So let's talk about if it were to be made into a state, hypothetically. Talk to me about D.C. right now. In terms of its population, how does it compare to some other current states?
Yeah, so right now, population-wise, it's larger than Vermont and Wisconsin. I can arguably say, having grown up in this area and driven all over the country, that you could probably drive through, even though Rhode Island's bigger than D.C., you could probably drive through Rhode Island faster than you could drive through D.C. if you went from one tip of 495 to, say, to a the Crystal City, Pentagon City section of Arlington.
Mm-hmm. And so what if it were to be given representation, how do you think that might change the lives of the people that live in DC?
So obviously the obvious is they would receive at least one member of Congress and two senators. With this new census coming up, I'd definitely be curious to see if they would pick it up two, if not three, members of Congress. But you know, that fact is one of the underlying reasons as to why this legislation is stymied, and why DC hasn't received a statehood since DC residents have been advocating this for the past 30 years, because you know. Power doesn't. Those with power don't give it up easy. In this case, those members of Congress and in the Senate would be Democrats, and thus tipping the scales of power within the Congress and the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, I guess some people might not like it being like sort of laid out in those clear terms, but it does simply seem like a politically pragmatic move by Republicans to block it if it would potentially throw off the numbers there. And I assume that's probably why this effort has been going on for so long without any actual progress. I mean, back in 1993, there was a proposal to make it a state, and it's I mean, we've had literally decades past now where it's been lagging.
Right. To me, it's definitely political play, especially now. I would say in years past too, there definitely was a strong racial element to it. For instance, most people don't know that DC City has to get its budget approved by Congress, right? And the only city in the country I know of that has to go through that process. So it's almost like a stepchild relationship that this city has with Congress, even though it's their own revenue.
Mm-hmm. So right now, potentially, we're going to have a vote. I assume the Senate, probably the Republicans, would be not too positive towards it. Do you think that if it made it to Trump's desk, do you think that there's any chance that he would actually sign it?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because you know the obvious answer would be no, but President Trump is so crazy and desperate for black votes and black support. Because every once in a while he'll go out in left field and do something that you define as the right thing, even though it's for selfish reasons. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like daring Mitch McConnell to let this thing get passed, so the president could pass it in order to gain some, you know, I guess maybe 0.1% additional black support mm-hmm. for his presidential reelection.
Yeah, and I think we should at least point out that, like, we both agree. They don't want it because those new representatives and new senators would be Democrats. But that is an admission that those Republicans are saying, we got nothing. We're not even going to try to appeal to these people. It's not like these people are genetically Democrats. Hypothetically, you right. could appeal to them if you were to put forward something that they found appealing. But there's a sort of tacit admission that is not coming. They don't think it would work, and they're not even going to offer it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sad that they would naturally assume that. I have black Republicans who are both friends and mentors, even though I'm staunchly Democrat, you know, who knows what would happen, right? Maybe it would revive black Republicans to be active in their party. Who knows? But as long as they want to hold hard to the party line of not giving the obvious additional representation or I guess number of votes to the Democrats, then we're always going to be stymied there.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I doubt they would see that as an opportunity that's worth exploring, but hey, right. The bill's there. It's available for them as an option if they want to go down that avenue. And Tyrone Sims II, we really appreciate you joining us and breaking this down.
Thanks, John.
Thank you. We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, misinformation about COVID-19. We're gonna talk about some of the implications after this. Here at the Damage Report, we have for weeks been incredibly critical of Donald Trump and Fox News for spreading misinformation about the coronavirus, both specific misinformation, but more importantly, telling their fans that this isn't something that you should worry about. And certainly, it isn't anything that you should change your behavior around. But here's the thing, it is at this late date still true that they're still doing it. they're still trying to encourage people to pretend that this isn't something that they need to worry about. Let's go to a little bit of Devin Nunes on Fox News.
And there's a lot of concerns with the economy here because people are scared to go out. But I will just say, one of the things you can do if you're healthy, you and your family, it's a great time to just go out, go to a local restaurant.
Yeah.
Likely you can get in easily. There's, let's not hurt the working people in this country that are relying on wages and tips to keep their small business going.
We're very sympathetic.
Don't run to the.
Understood.
Yeah, just don't run to the grocery store and buy $4,000 of food.
Right, they're cleaning off the shelves.
Go to your local pub.
We want to be very sympathetic to what's going on.
So, first off, stop doing every one of your interviews in front of tractors. This has nothing to do with tractors. Why are you doing your interviews in front of tractors? Second of all, Devin Nunes is the absolute worst for a couple different reasons. One, no, this is not a time when you should be taking advantage of the situation to go to every restaurant you want to go to. There are reasons that cities and states are shutting down restaurants because they are areas where enough people will congregate that they will be at risk of being exposed to coronavirus. That is simply a fact. And telling people that no, all of what you're hearing about staying at home, about limiting your exposure, that is all BS. You should just be living it up, having fun. And we're gonna talk about the implications of that, but I also just wanna briefly acknowledge that when he goes on there and says, we should be worried about people who, like their businesses might be hurt by this, that tipped workers might be hurt by this, that is 100% true. But the solution to that threat to these people is not for you to expose yourself to disease. It's for the government to make sure that they're not economically devastated by this. It's on people like Devin Nunes to actually go to work and pass a bill that's gonna protect people. No, putting the onus on you is passing the buck. It's not on you. You need to be worried about protecting yourself and your family and friends from exposure to this virus. And he's trying to hoodwink you into thinking that, no, you're actually the legislators. You're the one who's supposed to bail out everyone. But here's the thing, that message, you saw it from Devin Nunes, no, go out. We had Fox and Friends, what was it, last Friday? It's the perfect time to fly. They keep saying it, you shouldn't worry. And what do you know, some of their fans are starting to believe it. And so that's why, like over the weekend, tweets were going viral. Like when AOC tweeted to everyone in New York City, but especially healthy people and people under 40, because from what I'm observing, that's who needs to hear this again. Please stop crowding bars, restaurants, and public spaces right now. Eat your meals at home. If you were healthy, you could be spreading COVID. To which a person responded, I just went to a crowded Red Robin and I'm 30. It was delicious and I took my sweet time eating my meal because this is America and I'll do what I want. And look, we blurred out the picture and the name because I'm trying to avoid her being given a Fox show in the next week or so because that got 2,500 retweets. This is the sort of owning the libs by catching a virus sort of attitude that is becoming shockingly common. The idea that advice from medical professionals that's designed to protect you, but even more importantly, people who are elderly, who are immunocompromised, they're just trying to protect those people. And some of these red hat wearers believe, no, this is a threat to America and I'm not gonna be cowed by these terrorist doctors. That's effectively the attitude that you're seeing there. Or in tweets like this, downtown Nashville is undefeated as a video pans over a big crowd of people potentially catching coronavirus. No, we're undefeated if we support each other, if we rally to help each other, if we listen to the experts and try to stop people from dying from this illness, that's how we'll be undefeated. Refusing to listen to the experts, that's what we've been doing forever in this country. That is a continuing day by day defeat in the areas of public health, but also dealing with the climate crisis as well. And look, these are regular people, those last two tweets. I'm not even that mad at them. Because they're just listening to who they trust. The people in government and in media that they have been told are the only ones that tell them the truth. And lo and behold, they believe them when they tell them that you're cowing to defeat if you don't go out and get wasted at a bar right now. And that continued up until just yesterday even with people like David A. Clark Jr., the former Wisconsin sheriff that they love on Fox News that Trump was considering for a position in the Department of Homeland Security. He tweeted a bunch of things. I can't put up some of them because they're laced with profanities, but they include tweets like this. Go into the streets, folks. Visit bars, restaurants, shopping malls, churches, and demand that your schools reopen. Now, if government doesn't stop this foolishness, stay in the streets. End government control over our lives. If not now, when? This is an exploitation of a crisis. Shortly thereafter, he wondered why people weren't blaming this Jewish billionaire that the right always throws their conspiracy theories onto. He claimed that he was somehow responsible for coronavirus. Now, after this tweet storm, he's apparently, a lot of his tweets were taken down by Twitter because they encouraged people to kill themselves. So that's a guy that's on Fox News all the time saying that effectively you're not a good patriotic American unless you get into a big crowd right now. And people are doing it. Like, it's not just guests on Fox, it's the hosts on Fox. Sean Hannity claimed that people are faking concern about coronavirus just to quote bludgeon Trump with this new hoax. And so if you tell people that over and over, and then a doctor says maybe you should stay home, well, what do you know? Maybe that doctor just has a bludgeon for Trump. Pete Hegseth said, quote, "I feel like the more I learn about this, the less there is to worry about." On Hannity, he had a guest, a medical correspondent, Mark Siegel, who said that the worst case scenario with coronavirus, quote, is that it could just be the flu. No, that is not the worst case scenario for the goddamn coronavirus. But he was a medical expert brought on by a host that millions of Americans trust to misinform people. And it's not just the news, and it's not just government. Another group of authority figures for a lot of Americans are religious leaders, and some of them are giving people the worst possible information. Here's a bit of video. It's from the River Church in Tampa Bay, Florida. It's a revivalist church. Here's what their leader had to say.
"Well, I know they don't want us to do this, but just turn around and greet 2 or 3 people. Tell them you love them, Jesus loves them. Amen. Listen, this has to be the safest place. I said this has to be the safest place. This Bible school is open because we're raising up revivalists, not pansies."
Less worried about whether you're raising up pansies and more on whether these people will be raised up at all, because you are encouraging the transmission of coronavirus there. Look, there was a point perhaps where certain efforts might be too much panicking, but we're at thousands of cases now. We are trying to get past the worst of this. And there are people all over on the right who are encouraging people to not listen, to encourage people to get sick and potentially to die, and it's having an effect. I'm gonna give you some of the stats just once again. A new NBC News Wall Street Journal poll found that 56% of Democrats believe their day-to-day lives will change in a major way in the future, while just 26% of Republicans hold that view. 61% of Democrats said they've stopped or plan to stop attending large public gatherings, but only 30% of Republicans said the same. And so here's the thing. I don't know when we'll have the final numbers. Hopefully, once we've moved past coronavirus, it's not a thing that you need to think about anymore. Someone is going to do an analysis, and the number of people who got sick and who died is not going to be spread evenly across the ideological spectrum. More Republicans will get sick, more Republicans will die because they trusted the wrong people. And it is a tragedy. I know when I say these sorts of things, when I tweet these sorts of things, some people who ostensibly agree with me on politics will say, well, that's what they get. I'm sorry, maybe I'm a bleeding heart. I don't want anyone to die just because they disagree with me on politics. I am trying to do these videos and I'm trying to spread information to get through to these people to protect themselves and the people around them. And they are, unfortunately, they are being abused on a daily basis by people who they've put their trust in, who are telling them to do things, to continue doing things that could theoretically get them killed. And I personally see it as a tragedy. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, lots more to get to. Joining us now is a candidate for Senate in Delaware, Jessica Raine. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. Excited to talk about your candidacy and some of what's going on around the country that I'm sure is shaping pretty much every campaign right now. Before we get into, like, for instance, your platform and your opponent, tell us a little bit about you and what you're bringing to the race.
Yeah, so I'm a Delawarean who has been driven into this race based on what I've seen in the world around me. And that has really been that so many of the problems that we are seeing in the city of Wilmington, where I live, our state as a whole and our country as a whole, are really caused by this broken power of system that is holding up people who are already wealthy, already powerful, and forcing the rest of us to struggle so hard. And right now, we have a senator who upholds that system and who is not working hard to break it down. And that's why I believe that Delaware actually deserves a senator who's gonna take power back from corporations, who's gonna return it to the people and legislate in favor of the people of Delaware.
So let's talk a little.
My background is, go Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. No, tell me about your background.
Yeah, so my background is actually in digital marketing. You know, I have worked as a strategist and focused on building web and web apps and mobile apps. But in my spare time, I really focused on volunteer work and working for nonprofits. And that was how I tried to make change in my state for a long time. But what I started to realize is that when you are still working within this system that we have in play, that change is way too individualized and it's way too small to have the impact that we really need. So when I was tutoring, when I was mentoring young students, when I was working on the board of a nonprofit here that's focused on advocating for the rights of girls and women, yes, that made a difference, but it still didn't change the system that we were operating in. And that is what I think our federal government should be focused on. And that is why I want a seat at that table to actually bring the voice of the people that I was supporting through that nonprofit work into Washington, D.C.
So you talked about the limited ability to like radically change things on the outside. So let's say that you end up winning, you replace Chris Coons. What are some of the efforts that you would want to champion from the inside?
Yeah, we have a very bold platform, but some of the key things that we have focused on have really been driven by the conversations that we've had with voters. Very first top of mind is getting Medicare for all for this country. I think that is relevant right now, and it was relevant before this coronavirus outbreak as well. It is one of the top things that we hear at doors and on phone calls when we're talking to voters. Everyone recognizes that our healthcare system is broken and we need to fix it. I also really want to champion fighting for equitable education. As I mentioned, some of my background in nonprofit work was focused on education and tutoring and mentoring young students. And I see that as a real root cause problem to some of the other problems that we see in our country. And I believe we need to be championing free public education from childcare and pre-K all the way through trade school, public college. Because childcare costs are completely crippling families right now. And we tell students that they need to get some sort of higher education, yet the costs of that are crippling them. And I don't think the ability to pay should be a barrier to taking advantage of opportunity. We also know that go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry, continue.
No, I was going to say, we also absolutely need to combat the climate crisis. Delaware is the lowest lying state in the country. We are already seeing effects of climate change in our state, where farmers are losing land because salt water is infringing on freshwater. We have places in our state that flood even when it's not raining because the tides are so high, and do flood even worse when it does rain. So we are already on the front lines of this, and I propose that we need to sign on to a Green New Deal and would sign on to that legislation to fight back against climate change. I also would fight for things like particularly economic justice, raising the minimum wage to at least $15 an hour, as well as demilitarization of our police and broader decarceration to fight back against the prison industrial complex that has taken over our country.
You know, you mentioned coronavirus, and I'm sure just as you know, people in government right now are having to deal with it. If you're running for office right now, it's affecting that as well. We saw that you had tweeted recently, freeze all evictions, freeze all foreclosures, freeze all utility shutoffs. I know that obviously this sort of situation, this tragedy, must provide an opportunity for you to talk about how your agenda would impact it. But is it affecting the way you go about campaigning? Are you able to actually campaign in an active way with the sort of lockdowns that we're seeing starting to spread?
Yeah, so last week our campaign made the decision to stop going door to door. We want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. I am taking it very seriously that people should be staying home. Those that can. I recognize that there are some people who still need to go to work. And I think those of us who can stay home should, so that we can protect those people who need to be out and working still. So we went from having, close to 10 canvassing shifts every weekend, plus more during the week, where we had 15 people at a time coming out to canvass, to now completely stopping any of that in-person voter contact. So we are shifting primarily to phone banking right now. Mm-hmm. We had basically about 8 hours of phone banking both days over the weekend, and are continuing that every day, keeping our dialer open from noon to 8 p.m. every day so that we can reach voters that way, because we have seen that our name recognition is increasing. We have seen that people are buying into our platform, and we know that we can't take our foot off the gas when it comes to voter contact right now, despite this crisis.
And I believe that you've said that you're working full time while campaigning as well. Is that correct?
I am. Yes, I am. I unfortunately am not in a position to be without an income right now. So So I am continuing to work my job and sit in my campaigning on nights and weekends as best I can, because I, you know, like many people in Delaware and in the country, like, I can't just walk away from a paycheck right now and need to keep that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we've talked with a number of different candidates that because of the lack of public financing, it's having an obviously discriminatory effect on people who actually work for a living and can't just call on either high dollar donors or their own personal wealth to be able to smooth the way. Yeah. So, you know, I certainly feel for you in that struggle.
Yeah, that's particularly important in my race. Before I was even in this race, Senator Coons had raised about $3 million. When he first ran, he put about $250,000 of his own money into his campaign. I am not capable of doing that. We are not taking any money from any corporate PACs. We are solely raising money from small donors because, you know, that's one of the reasons that I'm in this race. I'm frustrated by the way that the senator has legislated in favor of the donors that he receives the most money from. I don't want to be beholden to any of those corporations who would come knocking on my door after elected asking for their favors to be returned.
Awesome. Well, I certainly agree with that. Jessica Rain, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Thanks so much.
We're going to take a short break here, but when we come back, a little bit more news to close out the show. Last night, following the Democratic debate, one of Biden's senior aides had this to say. This is Anita Dunn, senior advisor to Biden, said, "It's safe to say Vice President Biden showed up to a debate tonight and for 2 hours graciously dealt with a kind of protester who often shows up at campaign events on live television." Now, it's easy to like just sort of gloss over that, to just move past. But do you get how condescending that is in multiple different ways? That debate we saw, which was probably just by virtue of the fact that there were only two people and there was no crowd, was more substantive in laying out the differences between these two candidates than perhaps any other debate that we've seen so far. But obviously, the most clear way that this is incredibly offensive, dismissive, condescending towards Bernie Sanders is to say that for 2 hours, as he laid out what he saw to be the many crises facing the American people and a detailed idea of what he would do to try to solve these, a demonstration every step of the way of the values that have driven his political activity and strategy for his entire life, is he's a kind of protester who shows up at campaign events. Like, you're gonna try to appeal to not only this man, but to his supporters, the many people that you're gonna very soon want to support you if Biden is the nominee. And this is how you're doing it. This wasn't some random person who happens to like Biden. This wasn't a Biden surrogate. This is one of his senior advisors. What sort of advice is Anita Dunn providing to him if this is the way she approaches this massive and growing part of the party? Not to mention, of course, the condescension towards actual activists, people who would protest, people who care enough about an issue to show up at events and try to get people to finally think about it for a few minutes. I understand many people might find that to be temporarily like inconvenient or a little bit annoying, but nobody can doubt that these people are driven by a level of passion that centrists of the Democratic Party never seem to even get close to. But again, just like with Bernie Sanders, that whole area, the activists, the protesters, people like Anita Dunn look on those people with, at best, condescension. That was a great summary, by the way. A lot of people responded to this, but Naomi Klein had a great response saying, "Let this sink in. Understand that all of us in the Sanders campaign are seen as nothing but trespassers on their party property, and they absolutely cannot wait to call the cops." I mean, that is literally the metaphor that Anita Dunn chose to go with. That this guy who's been working for decades to make the Democratic Party the thing it needs to be, not only to help its base and America be what they need to be, but to make the Democratic Party effectively invincible electorally if they actually supported the Sanders progressive agenda. But she looks on it, at best, it's an inconvenience. Every 4 years we have to go through this thing and then push them to the side and then pretend that we want their support afterward. By the way, little note for the sort of person that we're talking about here. In addition to serving as acting White House communications director for part of former President Barack Obama's first year in office, Dunn was a consultant to Harvey Weinstein shortly before publication of the 2017 New York Times investigation into allegations of sexual misconduct against the Hollywood mogul, seen as a pivotal moment in the Me Too movement. So yes, she worked to try to advise and do some PR, some crisis management for Harvey Weinstein in 2017. Understand that in 2017, that's about 2 years after prosecutors in New York had already already investigated him for the number of very long-standing accusations of sexual harassment and sexual assault against this man. Now, by the way, I've seen the response from her saying, or from her team saying that she wasn't paid for this. It was just advice that she was providing, as if that's better. Like, you could almost say, well, I guess if you're getting paid, you're gonna do whatever. But you're offering up advice without even needing to be paid to one of the greatest monsters of our time. And then you're gonna talk about people who are just, they're annoying protesters. Oh, so gauche that they come on the stage and then bother Biden during his coronation. And yet they go and work for Harvey Weinstein. Very classy, that. Okay, we only have a few minutes, but let's turn to a very different topic. We don't talk about TikTok often on this channel, but boy, do we have a reason to now. With The Intercept getting a ton of documents that their internal moderators had used to try to weed people off of effectively their front page, the people that TikTok sort of pushes forward for people to see. Apparently, they had a very expansive list of things that could get you taken off of that, I guess, highway to superstardom. So on TikTok, live streamed military movements and natural disasters, video that quote defamed civil servants and other material that might threaten national security was suppressed, alongside videos showing rural poverty, slums, beer bellies, and crooked smiles. So you have things that supposedly are dangerous to national security down to, I don't like your belly fat effectively. Both of those things and everything in between could potentially derail your burgeoning TikTok career. One document goes so far as to instruct moderators to scan uploads for cracked walls and disreputable decorations in users' own homes, then to effectively punish those TikTok users by artificially narrowing their audiences. You know, like when the right would always talk about shadow banning? This is like as close as you can actually get to being shadow banned, but it's not for your ideology necessarily, although there's certainly political implications to this. But if you have teeth they don't like, if your wall is cracked, if you have, I guess maybe curtains that don't match well with the couch, hypothetically, you could get thrown off the front page for that as well. So let's go into some specifics. One moderation document outlined physical features, bodily and environmental, deemed too unattractive. So for instance, let's jump ahead. Abnormal body shape, ugly facial looks, dwarfism, an obvious beer belly, too many wrinkles, eye disorders, and many other low quality traits are all enough to keep your uploads out of sort of the fast track, the front page effectively of TikTok. Now, when they're asked about this, and it's great work by The Intercept and some others to make clear what these moderators were doing for some time, take a look at what they said. TikTok spokesperson Josh Gartner told The Intercept that most of the live stream guidelines reviewed by The Intercept, quote, are either no longer in use or in some cases appear to never have been in place, but wouldn't provide specifics about which is which. Regarding the policy of suppressing videos featuring unattractive, disabled, or poor users, Gartner stated that the rules, quote, represented an early blunt attempt at preventing bullying, but are no longer in place and were already out of use when The Intercept obtained them. By the way, those documents that supposedly the internet is saying were designed to protect these people from bullying, the word bullying never actually shows up there. And it's clear, they talk repeatedly about the fact that they are worried about these people who dare to have beer bellies decreasing the new user experience. They're worried that these people are too ugly, too poor, too politically out of the mainstream, that it's gonna turn off people when they're having their first TikTok experience. We know exactly what they were trying to do there. And look, hopefully it's true that they've moved on from some of these practices, but people need to know that that's what was going on. The experience you had on TikTok, you had that particular experience for a reason. It was a design, it was a strategy. Okay, with that, we do have a little bit of overtime. We have another clip that we're gonna do. So if you're a member, you can watch live on the app or on the website. That's gonna be available to you. For everybody else, thank you so much for joining me for this show. I understand we are in dark times, but we're gonna try to get through together. I appreciate you joining us every day. We'll see you tomorrow. For the rest of you, overtime continues in just a few minutes. For months now, Donald Trump has appeared to have done effectively nothing to stop coronavirus from beginning to spread across the United States. But that doesn't mean that like anything he might do is the right thing to do, the ethical thing to do. Take a look at this recent reporting. The Trump administration attempted to persuade a German firm developing a possible vaccine for coronavirus to move its research work to the United States. Okay, so far, that doesn't sound so bad. Moving them here, maybe giving them some support. Let's do that with a lot of companies. But supposedly, that's not where it ended. According to an anonymous source quoted in the newspaper, Trump was doing everything to secure a vaccine against the coronavirus for the US, quote, but for the US only. And that is obviously the headline here. The idea that hypothetically he's offering like a buttload of money, not just that they would move here or share their research, but that they would share their research and the eventual vaccine only for use by the United States. That strikes me as, in the time of a pandemic where thousands of people have already died, as evil, hypothetically. But I will say, we're gonna go through a little bit more here. I know that I'm supposed to have Trump derangement syndrome and I'm supposed to be totally unfair to him. I'm gonna need some additional sources on that, because as despicable of a human being as I think Donald Trump is, that seems to go past the line that even he would go. I hope I'm not being naive, but I can't imagine that anyone would hope to just gobble this up and then not make it available. Of course, we live in a world where people are jacking up the price of insulin by many times just because they can to make money. So I guess nothing is past a human. But anyway, let me give you a little bit more information. Another German official reached by the New York Times said it was unclear whether the administration simply wanted the research work and for any resulting production to be on American soil. And German health minister Jens Spahn said that a takeover of the CureVac company, that's the one we're talking about here, by the Trump administration was, quote, off the table. CureVac would only develop vaccines, quote, for the whole world, quote, not for individual countries. And the thing is, none of these German officials would say whether that anonymous source was right, but then they have quotes about, we want to make sure that these vaccines are available for everyone, which is a weird thing to say if that anonymous source is not telling the truth. Now, apparently the Trump administration has spoken with more than 25 companies that say they can help with a vaccine, one American official said, and is open to speaking with others. Any solution, according to this official, would be shared with the world. Now, here's the thing. They should be talking with all of these companies. They should be providing help to any of these companies that have, that are reputable, that actually could help to produce this vaccine. And in the world that I want to live in, once it's developed, it would be made available for every country to duplicate and to start to spread. The thing is, while I don't necessarily trust this anonymous source, I would want more confirmation of this before I believe that he was literally gonna do everything in his power to stop other countries from having it. That doesn't mean that everyone in the end is going to get this. We still can't get their officials to go on the record as saying that once it's available in the US, everyone will have it for free. Hypothetically, we might have access to it, but if it's costly to develop, and if they allow private companies to decide what the price is gonna be, then it could end up being out of the range of many, many Americans. And in the end, even in a world where we have the vaccine, people could still get sick and could still die from coronavirus. That is 100% a possibility here in the United States. And if it's possible here, do you really think that they would freely make it available to everyone around the world? They might make it available, but they're certainly gonna wanna be compensated for it. And in a time where this pandemic has opened, I think, a lot of people's eyes to how sick our system is and how it encourages these sorts of crises, this is the opportunity where we should be putting pressure on our government, not only to do the right thing in making it available for free to all Americans, but around the world, and to set up a system where we don't need to scramble in the face of every new emergency to come up with some stopgap solution. Let's set up a single payer healthcare system that makes sure that we're ready for it when it hits, okay? You can look at the news around the world. Countries on average are doing better if they had a government run healthcare system. It's not a cure all. Italy has been hit very hard, but it certainly appears to have helped. And in conjunction with a government that takes these sorts of things seriously and doesn't spin its wheels for literally weeks while it continues to develop, I think that is our best bet to dealing with coronavirus, but also whatever comes after the coronavirus. Okay, with that, thank you for sticking around, not only for the full show, but also for this overtime. We really do appreciate it. We got lots more planned for the rest of the week. I'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.